Lend me your ears. The Oral Dramaturgies Podcast. The Salon. Conversations about sound.
Hello, and welcome to The Salon. Today we welcome Mark Fleischman and Naomi Younger, frequent collaborators and parallel agitators of the South African scene. Mark Fleischman teaches at the Center for Theatre, Dance and Performance Studies at the University of Cape Town and is the artistic director of Magnet Theatre, established in 1987 in Johannesburg and based in Cape Town since 1994. He has created and directed many performance works for the company that have been performed nationally and internationally over the past 26 years, and is involved in development projects in urban townships and rural communities using theatre as a tool for social justice and transformation. He has edited the collection Performing Migrancy and Mobility in Africa, Cape of Flows, in 2016. And his articles have appeared in the South African Theatre Journal, Contemporary Theatre Review, and Theatre Research International, as well as in numerous edited collections. Naomi Younger was born in Soweto. He studied the Italian madrigal tradition with choral maestro Piero Poclen in Trieste before co-founding the acoustic pop duo Black Sunshine with Masauko Chipembere in the mid-1990s, garnering a following throughout Southern Africa and internationally. Neo writes music plays, chorus songs, and has a variety of works for chamber and large ensemble. His operetta, The Flower of Shembe, premiered to critical acclaim in 2012. He co-founded the Pan-African Space Station in 2008 with Chimurenga's publishing editor, Natone Jabe, as a continually evolving host of cutting-edge Pan-African music and sound art on the internet and across stages in Cape Town and other parts of the globe. In this salon, Mark and Neo reason together on the role of speech, sound and music in a number of their performance works, including their collaborations on the 2015 opera adaptation of Zakis Madar's novel Heart of Redness, and their Antigone, Not Quite Quiet, from 2019, detailing their working processes and understanding of vocal, rhythmic, and choreographic dramaturgies. The idea of an African approach to performance is put forward, in which the sonic dimension of the work becomes a character in its own right, an agent that will fill historical gaps, bind different audiences together, and help articulate current political problems. The conversation was recorded via Zoom between Cape Town and London on the 2nd of July, 2020.
Okay, good afternoon there. How are you?
I'm fine. Good afternoon, Mark. How are you?
Okay. So I thought it would probably be a good place to start just to introduce ourselves, who we are, and how we define ourselves on the work that we do. I am Mark Fleischman. I am a professor of theatre in the Center for Theatre, Dance and Performance Studies at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And I'm also co-artistic director of Magnet Theatre, which is an independent company that has been making theatre performance work in South Africa since the mid-1980s, so a period of over 30 years. So I'm partly an academic, partly a dramaturg, partly a director, partly a theatre maker, whatever one you want to choose.
I am Neo Muyanga. I am a musician, composer, a sound artist, one could say. I work mainly across the genres of new opera, African idiomatic song, and particularly interested in voice and the work that voice does as a measure of history and protest and the Black diaspora in articulating its own history. And Mark, you and I have been working together for, I was thinking about it the other day, probably over a decade. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
So Magnet is like a home for me also. So very much close to that practice.
I think one of the things that interested me about this conversation and the project that it forms part of was the dual focus on orality and orality. And the way that I understood that was orality, with an O being essentially a kind of framework or paradigm for approaching the world in some way, whereas orality is more of a focus on hearing in the context like sound per se and how it's heard. Orality is more like a, let's say, a conceptual way of hearing and a way of making too. And both of those things have a very strong resonance within the African and particularly Southern African context that we work in. I did my master's thesis in the early 80s on the ways in which research into orality might form the basis for an understanding of theater making practices in South Africa. At that time, what we called workshop theater, and it was the era of protest theater, the anti-apartheid protest theater of the time, and postulated that the particular structural approaches to understanding orality in the work of people like Milman Parry and Albert Lord, et cetera, would be a way of understanding the way that the new dramaturgies and the new ways that theater was being structured at the time. And I still believe that to a large extent, a lot of the work that's being produced in performance terms in South Africa today, 27 years after apartheid, is to a large extent influenced by those same oral poetics, those same ideas. On the other hand, Magnet started off as essentially a physical theater company, and it was very much influenced by my partner Jenny's background in training with Lecoq. And there was a particular moment in the work that we did where we started to focus more on sound and what sound was doing in the productions. And that moment occurred just before we met and just before we started to collaborate together in that first production, which was Rain in a Dead Man's Footprints. I was making a work at the District 6 Museum on forced removals, which basically was an outdoor, site-specific, physical theater-based piece, which didn't have a text. It was a series of tableaus, moving tableaus, that were performed to a kind of end-to-end, wall-to-wall soundtrack. And I had, in a very quick way, gone into a recording studio with some very iconic Cape Town musicians who had a connection to District 6, Hilton Schilder, Mac McKenzie, Robbie Janssen, and recorded a whole lot of music in the styles that came out of District 6, District 6 being a particular area of Cape Town, for those people who don't know, a working class, mixed race suburb that was under the Group Areas Act under apartheid, people were removed from, but it was never rebuilt as a suburb after the removals. And there's a long history of memory studies and memory activities and rituals connected to that, of which performance and carnival is particularly connected. So it was the first time that we actually did a piece which kind of combined to some extent the physical theater background of the company with a very, very clear kind of sonic landscape, a particularly musical one, made up both of newly recorded music, but also archival clips that we had got hold of. And that was the moment, I think, that we started to see the kind of emergence of sound and music and voice as being particular to Magnet's work. And then soon after that, we started a series of collaborations together, which actually started through the Jazz Art Dance Theatre. So our first collaborations were about working on dance. We were both not dancers, for obvious reasons, but we were we were coming to this from our own perspectives, me as a director, dramaturg, you as a composer. Do you have memories of that time and what you think what you thought we were doing then and what you think did happen as a result of that interaction?
Yeah, I mean, I remember very clearly how Jazz Art is a very particular company because it's the oldest contemporary African dance company apparently on the continent, but certainly in this country. So they have a very particular tradition and history, which I'd heard about and read about. And I was very curious to discover how they worked with questions of the history that made Cape Town, which is what we were touching on with Rain in a Dead Man's Footprints, this idea of these old stories that came from the 19th century of the ending somewhat of the colonial era and the beginning somewhat also of what would become the apartheid scenario. And what interested me was to try and work with you on the one hand in terms of the academic input that you were making about what the archival collection was that we could read and think about, but also looking at what the choreographic language would have been. So I would walk in with a notebook, mainly to notate what was happening with the movement, with the dancers' feet and with their voices and how their bodies moved in space. So it was very much premised in the beginning on counting beats, counting bars, making sure that the tempo was something that they would be able to use to replicate whatever the choreographic language was on top. I would take those notes home and transcribe them into some kind of template that I would then create sonic responses to. And then I would bring that back a few days later to the studio and to yourself, and we would try it with the dancers and see where it would go. So the practice for me was to play two roles. One was to interpret what I was seeing on the floor and what I was hearing in the room, and then to integrate the information that we were finding about the kind of music that would have been relevant to the time, to that particular tradition that we were speaking to, the particular community we were talking about. The Klam, who are based in the Northern Cape, was a particular inspiration because they, Alfred and John, who were the founders of one of the key founders and people who made Jazza, came from. And they were accessing language from there and work that you had done previously with them, I think, to do with that tradition. So I had quite a lot of catching up to do on that score. So luckily I had a lot of reference archival material of my own. I had some recordings of so-called Bushman songs that had been released by Melt 2000. And there were lots of other recordings that I had on tape. And I found some other material through the process of researching with you. So all of that for me was in the back of my mind while I was trying to firstly understand what the bodies were saying in space. And then to respond to you dramaturgically with music and sound that would not only accompany the action, but would also somehow embody a terrain, embody a kind of landscape, embody a kind of mind space and sonic space also.
You know, I think the important thing for me to stress is that I don't think at the end it was a case of you making music to dance to, that the tracks, as it were, of the sonic dramaturgy, and if you like, and the physical dramaturgy were running in parallel with each other and intersecting and touching on each other in certain ways, so that it wasn't just a case of one thing supporting the other. Was that something that you felt as well?
Yeah, very much. I very much felt that there was a brief, but also an expectation for the sonic space to become a character. So to be able to tell its story, to be able to narrate something of itself. So I had to, for example, step into a role, a kind of sonic musical role, that was not just about responding to dancers who need music and to be the musical director, but it was about how I would also become a character, not me, Neil, but the entity that was performing the sound, the sonic space, to a point where the movement, the dance, the storytelling could lean on that as a set or as a kind of a dialogic partner. So I very much saw my role as contingent on what was happening. It would change every single night. I mean, we made it as a live show, so it would have to be necessarily responsive to what was happening on any given night. And it felt like I had to, at every point, renew my kind of commitment to what the place of sound was going to be for that particular occasion. I remember particularly, you know, dancers have a very interesting relationship to sound, because in some ways, there's a reliance on sound being the same in order for them to be able to reach the hit points that they would have settled on in the choreographic design. And at some points, there was a tension there between me having to become the kind of performer, the kind of musician who could constantly replicate what was decided upon as that is the right sound at this place, and also having to be a person on stage who was responsive to what was happening and to what was emerging in that particular moment. So the dancers at various points would say, but you didn't play it like you played it last week or yesterday. And my response would be, yes, but I felt we needed to respond to how you were feeling or how I was feeling today, not yesterday. But I also had to, in some ways, determine how to set some of the stage for the sonic happenings to follow. I think it was always a calibration every time we had to perform. Sometimes it worked really much better than others, I find.
It seems that what you're describing there picks up on some fundamental characteristics of what might call a kind of African approach to performance or understanding of performance, which is not scripted, and the tension that exists in all the work that we do between the kind of Western conception of theatre or performance as being something rehearsed, something prepared for, scripted, and then repeated, versus a more African conception in which, while there is a tradition and there is a knowledge of that tradition, that performance is a space for creativity, innovation, for improvisation, if you like, within that traditional structure. And how those two conceptions play out in contemporary performance in a Southern African context. I'm very aware of the differences when you are actually playing live in a performance and when you have recorded that music and the performers are responding to the recorded track. One of the other things about Rain in the Dead Man's Footprints, which I think is important to understand, is that the dancers were also singing. They were not silent dancers. So there was a whole other element to the kind of sonic landscape, which was the vocal one. Partly you were singing, partly they were singing. They were dancing while singing. So the kind of accuracy of the singing was kind of different. So it also speaks back to a kind of aesthetic, if you like, that's not about necessarily the perfect note and the need to also, in a sense, recover constantly when you go off that note because you are in the midst of exertions, physical exertions of one kind or another. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a huge leap to make, because on the face of it, I was musical director, let's say, and I would, on the one hand, be coming in to give vocal warm-ups, vocal lessons. And at some point, we rehearsed like a choir. That was part of the rehearsing process. I would have sections of time where I was alone with the dancers to do vocal work. And then they had to become dancers again. And I, in a way, would lose some measure of my singers to the physical performance. And we had to find some kind of mitigating bridge between those spaces. So then the sonic space had to be a kind of sonic environment that could survive that, that had the kind of muscle that could support them when they needed to be more physical, but also could imply what that physical exertion meant in terms of what they would sound like in the end. So we had to think a lot about where the pauses are for them to be able to do the kind of choreographic expression they needed to do, but also where I needed them to be a lot more vocally focused because the scene needed that and not so much for them to be out of breath at a particular moment. But it also meant, for example, that the lesson around keys and really staying on certain notes at some points became imperative. But I had to ultimately learn to understand the way I hear music as a musician is not necessarily the way a dancer who's able to sing and articulate musically hears music. And what they're hearing as a cue in terms of what I'm providing, or what I think I'm providing, is being read in a different way, whether they're reading it as a dancer or whether they're reading it as a member of the chorus. And those kinds of discoveries were new for me, because I had never worked like that before. So it transformed my practice fundamentally, I would say. And it transformed my understanding of, you know, what you often speak about, this the idea of the chorus in the Greek sense, this representation of voices. And that can be a community, that can be a society, and it can be a conscience, and it can be a kind of an objective or objectifying, alienated space of commentary. That began to play a lot of role for me. And I also was thinking from the perspective of having come from watching protest song, protest theater. Gibson Kente was a big influence in my life growing up. Sarafina and the work of Bungeni Ngema really informed how I came to writing for the theatrical space and the vocal theater, opera included in that. And so those were some of the ways I was practicing for myself what would be my own voice in working with those principles.
So then, you know, that Rain in the Dead Man's Footprints was one of a whole series of works that were particularly focused on archives, and particularly the archives of Cape Town, as it was emerging as a city. And the second production was Cargo, which was based on the archive of slavery at the Cape.
Yeah.
So there, I think we came in with a slightly more developed understanding of what we were doing. I think in Rain, we were quite reactive to what was happening in the moment. Yeah. Whereas with Cargo, I felt certainly dramaturgically, we were enacting a particular dramaturgy or dramaturgical method that we had already discovered in earlier projects. And yeah. I know that we have a clip of one of the songs that came out from Cargo. Do you want to talk a little bit about why you chose that clip?
Yes. The clip is a piece, a ballad called Ballad of a Mutiny. Cargo for me was a learning curve in terms of how, in some ways, trying to stay true to some element, some measure of an archive, a historical archive that was particularly traumatic and that didn't have any sonic references for me. So we began thinking about what the music of slaves would have been. There's no reference for us to that. The references are Western music that may have been imported and where a master would have asked or demanded slaves learn and play. So quadrilles, for example, became of prominence and people were playing Western-made instruments, violins, cellos, celli di gamba, and particularly voices and percussion from Asian influence, from Indian influence would have made a showing. But we didn't have recordings that I could listen to, and there isn't a recording or a score that I could refer to. So part of this brief was having to respond from my imagination of what this would have been had disruptions by slavery and colonialism not happened, not taking place. The song, The Ballad of a Mutiny, is written from the perspective of one of the characters whose name in the archives we found was Thomas van den Galen. He would have been named Thomas by his master. Van den Galen would have been a slave that was brought from Bengal in India, or around the Bay of Bengal in India, and which we know is where some of the slaves were brought from. And it was describing this character who refused to submit and wanted to run away from slavery. And there was a practice of running away and running to a place just outside Cape Town, Piketberg. And there was a particular community that would be settled there. And that community was perceived as, I don't know, what people I guess would call pirates or gangsters today. A group of people who had to make a living. And they had a particular code of conduct and a particular discipline among themselves. And so the song, the ballad, is trying to tell the story from their perspective, from the perspective of this person who runs away, achieves freedom of a certain measure, wants to live freely, but also has to live according to violence, because that's the system in which they are surviving. Eventually, they get captured. And it tells what happens in the moment when he's captured as well, which is trying to play on one hand on being narrative of this particular character, but on the one hand is us in the 21st century trying to deal with the trauma of what Cape Town has become. If you play it, I'll tell you a bit more about the particular characterization that I took on after you play the clip.
Slavehood. to return. Boldly they fled to the Mount of Picketburg, wearing muskets filled with powder, escaping to the wild. In 12 was all his company who conspiracy would heed. Journeying to freedom, food became rare to meet. The band of runaway slaves made for to steal the master's beast. Being discovered by commando, slaves and soldiers faced each other steel. Bodies falling down at the water's edge. In 12 was all his company who mutiny would seek. These are the arms of Batavia. These are the arms of Batavia. Thomas Van den Galen captured, he faced his choice. Taking hold a blade, he placed it along his throat. He began to bleed, his captors retreated, they were pleased. But Thomas didn't die, he became a storyteller's keep. These are the arms of Batavia. These are the arms of Batavia.
I'm sure you remember, Mark, how terrible I am as an actor. so I can perform characterization if I'm working through the language of music and the language of song. So we had a particular moment where we spoke about the character who would tell the story, what he would look like, what he would feel like. And what we were exploring was a kind of character in a Western, if you like, somebody who has to deal with the harsh elements, almost pioneering in a space that has no provisions whatsoever and having to survive by their wits. So it's a character that carries a guitar, but also carries a sword and possibly a rifle of some sort. It's a hard living kind of character, but we needed to find a way also for that to be close to the story we were trying to tell in terms of the historicity of the elements that we use musically. And I was thinking about what the instruments would have been at that time. I mean, the guitar would have been available. The harp would have been available as a house instrument that somebody who was running away could have run away with. So those are the two spaces that I began working with. And also as instruments that I would be performing on stage. But it was designed on this idea of also creating a kind of a triplet beat, almost like a waltz, that is about this journey, is about walking towards somewhere. It's uneven. It keeps us moving forward. It's got an element of lament and sadness in it. It's suggestive of all of these possibilities that I would have been able to embody, I not having the talents to act or to move around at that point. I would have been able to embody that through characterizing it musically. And it seemed to work. We had another version of that, which was me trying to pretend to be a more Bob Dylan kind of character. So where the note was not so much the thing to be religiously staying on top of vocally while the musical harmony was proceeding. That also worked and would have worked as an expression, but the range of that for my voice would have been very difficult for me to carry night to night. So these were some of the considerations for me, is ultimately the version the song came to take was a version that I could keep repeating, a version that could set up the structure of the harshness of the step of the person who was running, but also could be able to tell an effective story just if somebody would close their eyes and listen to the design that was being created.
Just talking about character, soon after that, we kind of started to collaborate on what might be called more theater pieces as opposed to dance pieces or dance theater pieces. And there are three of those that I can refer to. The first one being Every Year, Every Day I'm Walking, which was a very hastily produced work that became the longest surviving piece in the repertoire, per se. It's still being performed to
every
this day.
Every day.
12 or 13 years later, whatever. So that's one side of it. And there I'm particularly interested in the way in which the music has been described by audiences all over the world as being a third character, as basically a two-hander. But people in the audience constantly say the music is the third character. And I believe that characters operating slightly differently in that production than what you were describing in the character of the Thomas van Bengalen song in Cargo. The other two pieces were The Fire Raisers by Max Frisch and the creation of the puppet chorus of firemen in that production, singing in a particularly local singing tradition, not local to Cape Town necessarily, but to South Africa, a Spatamia tradition, which is most commonly associated with Ladysmith Black Mambazo internationally. And that was also choral, it was puppet singing, it was this particular way of singing. And then the third one, Voices Made Night, which was an adaptation of short stories by the Mozambican author Mia Kuto, where we were working very much with not only music, which was there, and you were responding to what the actors were doing on stage from the piano, but also the way in which we were creating particular vocal landscapes or vocal scores that moved beyond the semantics of language. So it wasn't what only the words that they were speaking, but the sounds that they were making in chorus, the way that those sounds and the kind of onomatopoeic and other kind of ways of expanding or extending the range of the performer's voice to create something that was heightened beyond the everyday, but wasn't song per se. It wasn't musical in a way that the others are. Do you want to just talk a little bit about anything related to those three?
Yes. I mean, firstly, the Fire Raisers. You know, Scatamia, yes, as you say, is a sound, a sonic space that is outside South Africa best understood through the lens of Ladysmith Black Mambazo, because they are the biggest band we have that's won numerous Grammys and are famous as a South African band worldwide to such an extent that they've actually started to define for people outside South Africa what the South African choral sound is. In fact, there's a vocal effect on GarageBand that you find in the Mac and Apple that is called South African Choir. And those effects are mimicking Ladysmith Black Mambazo. So it's become ultra, ultra meta mainstream. The difficulty and the challenge there was, again, working with actors. You know, the advantage, but also the complexity in working with South Africa is everybody here, or it feels like everybody here, has a capacity to represent musically. Many of us come from backgrounds that make us feel able to articulate ourselves musically, harmonically. And a lot of that is done through voice. So working with voice is not strange for many actors who come from the South African context. But to be specialist vocalists is another ask. And Scatamia is an a cappella tradition. So there I had to work with the chorus as an a cappella group that couldn't lean on music that came from elsewhere to keep tuning, to keep timing. So people actually had to learn very definitive line structures, musical melodic line structures in terms of vocal parts that are very similar to four-part harmony writing in the way that a normal conventional choir would work, except we were not singing normal conventional choral music. We were telling stories, and they had to find ways every single iteration of remaining in tune with one another, having a particular tempo timing, and remembering the story that was being told. They had characters that were also involved with other things. So each member of the chorus also had an individual role to play. So very much like asking an opera singer who has a role as a star to then be a member of the chorus. It's a very difficult transition to make. And it was very successfully done, I thought. But because we had to do a lot of workshop work in preparing for it. So, I mean, the haste doesn't help if the scenario is having to prepare something of that level of complexity. So every day we had to find ways of remembering what we did and what worked and what didn't. For me, I learned a lot about working harmonically with people who sing in a kind of a free expression, but don't necessarily sing as members of a trained choir. Because my background includes both styles of work. And I sometimes use them interchangeably without recognizing in myself necessarily at what point I'm reaching for which skill. So to be working with a group like that really brings it to the fore and help me understand in my own practice at what point the transition moments are and what to focus on depending on the kind of group I was working on or with. Every year, every day I'm working, for me was, yes, characterization of a different kind. I felt very present on stage in the moments where I was performing with that production. So I had to find a way of sitting, and I was sitting the entire time. I had to find a way of sitting that lasted comfortably the whole performance. I only had one instrument at that point. It was an electric guitar. And I chose an electric guitar because we knew very early in the production that we would be going touring, but we would be going touring through parts of the continent that didn't necessarily have resources like huge mixers and bins for feeds back and hearing yourself monitoring on stage. So I had to find an instrument that could be easy to carry through those kinds of travels, but also that could speak in multiple ways, because the story was telling about a difficult journey moving from the Congo and transitioning through very violent, very dangerous borders onto the streets of Johannesburg in South Africa as a migrant, and what languages that would imply and what possibilities in creating different kinds of tension, but also different kinds of joy and rhythm. So the electric guitar, and some people have said this, the electric guitar really should be thought of as an African instrument by now, because of how, for example, the Congolese have transformed the relationship of the electric guitar to music, dance music, but also to music of African tradition through the rumba and through Kwasa Kwasa. So the choice there was about embodying a very particular character that would have to translate the journey from the Congo, roughly the Congo, I was thinking, because it's a French-speaking country, to South Africa. And what would change, what would transition in that, I had to elaborate through guitar pedals. And that was a huge joy for me. I got to know my electric guitar pedals very well. In fact, I had to buy one particularly new one to be able to do a certain kind of looping, and also to be able to play the role of translating what the two actors on stage were doing when in sections where they were speaking either in French or in an invented gibberish language, the guitar would be the translation for people in South Africa about what was being said at the time.
But also I think that the music there creates a kind of, I mean, because it's kind of, in theater studies terms, poor theater, there's very little on stage. They're the bodies of the performers. There's a very, very limited text, which is changing from French to English as they move down the continent. So the landscape that they're traversing to a large extent is depicted both the physical landscape, but also the affective emotional landscape that they're traversing is being depicted to a large extent through the music and through the way the music is changing and evolving along the way through the three-part structure of the dramaturgy.
Yeah.
So it's playing that, I think, a very important part of filling the empty space, so to speak, with a particular texturing, which makes the piece feel so much more bigger than it actually is when you simply like reduce down to the sum of its parts.
But we've also spoken about what changes from the moment when I'm touring with the piece versus the moment when I can't tour anymore because of other commitments, and the recording accompanies the two actors. So that's what you're describing still takes place. But the first instance is me responding to the actors on stage. And the subsequent instance is different for the actors because it's about having a score that they follow.
Mm.
Is that
fair? That goes back to what I was saying before about in the beginning, it's much more like an African experience for me because it's this conversation, this dialogical conversation going on between the body of the performer, the storyteller, so to speak, the musician and the space in a particular way. And once it gets recorded, it turns and becomes, the music becomes almost the script that the actors are following. So the actors are to some extent being conditioned by what has been predetermined by the script. And I think that shifts it slightly as it goes on over time. I mean, fundamentally, it does the same thing and it had longer life in the latter mode than in the former mode. But I think it does qualitatively change the experience for an audience. And then in Voices Made Night, in the particularity of the performers, the vocal work that was going on there, which was more an extension of speech than song. What do you think about that? Do you have any
thoughts? We had very different voices at that point. We spoke very specifically about the actors you chosen to play certain roles. And there was one actor, Mfundo, who participates in choral activity, who's a friend I know in choral circles and township singing circles. And then there was another actor, Shimene Ball, who was trained in opera and could sing that style. And so I had available this possibility of working in this twin mode of somebody who could do this lyrical bel canto line. And so the piano helped with that and the church music, the church personality that we were embodying in certain sections of those stories helped work with that versus the choral energy that had a call, like a call and response, this antiphonal energy that comes from the township, but also comes from our more indigenous style of musicking, was another palette that I could apply in that production. So those two poles, I think, helped create a complexity and a different kind of complexity to what we had previously worked with. Certainly for me, vocally, I had a space to then play with a lot of that characterization also, to tell the story of these differences in the South African or Southern African soundscape. Mm.
Just before we move on to talk about the most recent work that we did, the Antigone production, can you just reflect a little bit on Heart of Redness and very specifically on approaching opera, which was where we were working with a combination of trained opera singers and these kind of performers that we've been talking about up until now?
That was a fascinating moment for me to try and articulate what I thought could be done in making new propositions for opera as a space outside of the Western paradigm or the European paradigm. And as you know, I strongly believe that opera has a very particular voice in a particular space from a Southern African perspective, because people have been working here with opera for over 150 years in a way that could qualify as possibly an indigenous or other version of the operatic. The challenge was working with opera singers from an opera company that are trained in the classical European Western tradition as half the ensemble. And the other half of the ensemble were Magnet Theatre, who are trained in physical theatre, workshop theatre, who are bodies in space that can invent and can respond to direction in a way that makes them co-conspirators, co-originators, vocally as well as dramatically. So on the one hand, we had to work with what these two worlds would be saying to one another with what I felt was an opera company that wasn't yet convinced that it could work in a different register to what would have been considered the Western register. So we had a lot of convincing to do, a lot of musical convincing to do. And one of the ways I had to do that was to deliver a fully written, fully through composed score. Through composed is what they would call it, because they've got every part of what is supposed to happen from beginning to end on the stage. And unless it's on the stage, it doesn't exist. They don't improvise, they don't invent, they don't come up necessarily with something they think would be better or equal or adding tension to the character, unless it's notated. So I had to, first of all, be fair and deliver that, because there's a huge respect from my perspective, certainly, for the training and the ability that somebody who's trained in that way has for working on stage. But at the same time, I come from the perspective of having huge respect for people who workshop ideas in a way that allows them to be representative of what they themselves feel needs to be said and how it has to be said at that particular point. And we were also dealing with the complexity of the book. Zeg Sundar's very thick, very long, very complex book, Heart of Redness, transitions over a period of many lifetimes for what might be one character, but who has many different lives as the progenitor, as the ancestor, as the progeny of a particular, the same name maybe used for different people. So you had, I think, a brilliant impulse there, which was to have the same character played by two people at a time. And there was one moment where on paper it looked crazy to have one Noma Rashia who was an actor, a magnet actor, and another Noma Rashia who was an opera singer. And they were at the same time articulating the role and an audience who had to follow the story. So I thought we went out very much of all of our comfort zones at that point, because we had to deliver what would be a score, what you were describing in terms of being a script that the actors had to follow, and the music, because we had a live ensemble that was playing that I was conducting, couldn't be stopped. When you begin an opera, you have to finish it, right? And you can't take a break, and you can't revise, and you can't improvise a particular section. So that was a train that was moving that people had to stick to. But you had improvising magnet actors that were imposing themselves on top throughout. And we had a third dimension, which was an audience of opera lovers from the township who are not necessarily called opera lovers, but they are, because the townships in Black South Africa are full of people who follow opera. They don't necessarily go to the opera house, but they follow opera. But they also follow the tradition that informs opera, which is the choral tradition in South Africa. And they could understand the references that we were making from the stage, from the operatic space, from the choral space. And also from the tradition that Zeg Sundar, his book speaks to, of the Eastern Cape and the coming together of the colonial dispensation together with the indigenous population. So at some point we had at the very front while performing the classical opera audience of Cape Town Opera who were in suits and ties, who were expecting a particular kind of etiquette, who were very proper. And then at the back, we had the voices of the township that were responding to what was happening on stage and singing back and interjecting back to a point where it reflected what I think we all think is the operatic in Southern African terms. But I know that certain people are very troubled by it and they ask me, well, how did you even conceive of doing that? Or as if we had been inventing it from nowhere. And my response was, we were responding to what we know happens anyway. And we put it on stage in order to come to terms with it ourselves. But also for me, my personal project there was trying to bring the world of opera that I love so much closer to what I think is the forgotten practice space of the operatic in Southern Africa, which is a choral movement in South Africa.
I know that you can carry on talking about that for a very long time, but in the interest of this time, I'd like to move on to the Antigone project, which is the latest thing that we did together, which is part of a research project which is reimagining tragedy in Africa and the global South. As part of that production, Antigone, Not Quite Quiet, it was a triptych created with three parts. The first part being Ismene is a solo performed by Jenny Resnick in what might be called a dramatic mode. The middle part is Antigone, which was performed by a chorus of about 13 people, most of whom, 99% of whom were Black. And that was done essentially through sound and music. And that was what I asked you to create for the piece. And the third part was a media installation on a triptych of three screens, a video installation of a particular Xhosa poem from the from the early 20th century. Can you just talk a little bit, because we also have a little bit of sound about that, that and your approach to that and what that Antigone section actually was for you?
That was a huge privilege to work on, because we were working with a very young group of people. People who are at Magnet and people who are at UCT. Center of Performance. I really was excited about working with people who had very strong opinions about the story they wanted to tell. We started by asking them, for example, what a character like Antigone would represent, not just in the world, but what that character would represent for them in South Africa today. And we were speaking very pointedly to people who were coming from participating in the Thieves Must Fall, Roads Must Fall movement, people who were very involved in the idea of what South Africa has become post-democratically. And we were asking them to think about a voice that says no, and the body that says no, and what it articulates and how it articulates. And the brief from you, based on the text we were working on, and the translation we were working on, was about what if we imagine this body now after the sentencing. So in a cave where Antigone ends up finding herself, what kind of dark space, what kind of things can be articulated from that space? Is the entity speaking from back from the grave, back from the dead, or are they speaking from the afterlife? Or are they speaking as a presence that we've decided to ignore? So I had to think about the sound space, the sonic space for that, but also my request was for the actors we had to form one body. So each one of them has personal opinions and personal talents and personal ways of articulating. We asked them specifically to articulate as one body, as one character. And what came out was interesting, much more interesting than I could have imagined. If you play the clip that you have now, I'll be able to speak more pointedly about the particular principles we were touching on there. There's a lot of talk I know lately about the technology in theater and performance particularly. So the idea of immersive sound or binaural sound is very, very present. And I think this would, I would say, qualify as a low-tech version of these kinds of experiments where we wanted to put an audience inside this landscape, the soundscape that is constantly shape-shifting and moving, that is mysterious. And to do that, we had microphones everywhere. We made the stage live, and we made made choices about bringing low resonance. We had a subwoofer in the room to really flutter below the audience so that they were impacted on by the bass and they were part of a moving scenario. It wasn't a comfortable space of sitting outside of the action and watching as it proceeded. And I think the actors stroke singers really took that on very seriously. So they would perform, for example, the idea of extending their vocalizing. They would accentuate their body movements so that the feet and the hands were creating percussion and they were creating sonic space that was telling the story together with the way they chose to use their voice. And then they were using texts and textual references to particular historical moments in South Africa. So the speech that Sive is making there has references in what would have been the Freedom Charter speech of the 1950s in South Africa. That was one of the places that people looked to identify what Black people who were fighting against apartheid had as an aspirational expression for themselves and what united people around a particular cause. And I feel like the young people we were working with are very much feeling like these are days for articulating a new cause. And I think what we were very keen to do was make a space for that to be articulated and for ourselves to understand it. And they were speaking very much also back to South Africa's particular problem of gender-based violence. We had many young Black women in the ensemble who were very affected by the stories of gender-based violence that were being reported in the media around the time that we were rehearsing. And in fact, we had to take a decision to postpone rehearsal in one particular moment so that people could participate in a march and that people could articulate on the street. And I remember saying how I detected a transition, the emotional quotient that came back to rehearsal when they came back to the floor was significantly engaged and different, because they felt like this was the story they wanted to tell from their own lives. It wasn't just a story about Antigone that happened in Greek mythology. It was about the story they wanted to tell today. So we were trying to work through very lo-fi technology, microphones, making a whole space live, but we were also making an audience complicit in the story that was being told.
And I think what is happening there is there's these various strata, if you like, of sound texture or material that is being layered on top of each other in that space, even in that little clip, because you've got the recorded sound of the opera from another time and another place, which is in a kind of distorted way resonating. And then you've got the sound, the percussive sounds that they're making on the floor at the same time through the kinds of choral dance moves that are happening or gestural actions that are happening at the same time. And then you have the poetry, which speaks to a particular tradition of spoken verse. And as you say, reflects back on a particular text from a particular political moment in South Africa. So there's a whole lot of time, space, and sonic strata that are engaged in an overlapping kind of way or a simultaneous kind of way in the space at the same time. There's a kind of depth effect as opposed to a kind of narrative linear development effect happening in the piece. I mean, obviously there is a linearity just unfolding in time, but there is also that sense of the strata and the depth that is being reflected at the same time. We've come pretty much to the end of this conversation and our conversation time. And, you know, what I really appreciated is not so much a kind of teleological development of the work from, say, new writing to physical theater to sound, but a kind of coexistence of all of these things at the same time. So that in each of the works that we're doing, a little bit of each of those things is present all of the time. Thank you very much for joining me in this conversation.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and to think with you. Thank you, Mark.
You've been listening to Lend Me Your Ears, presented by Duška Radosavljević, curated by Flora Petrolo, and produced by Tim Dano. The Lend Me Your Ears podcast is part of Oral Dramaturgies, an AHRC leadership fellowship held by Dusko Radosavljević at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama.